Simonson. Welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jacob Kanzler, John Rurink, and Simon Schuster. A little later, Elmer Serrano from Michigan Protection Advocacy Service will join us, as well as State Representative Tom Elbert to talk about the MIPSERS package. But guys, we had a pretty busy week last week, and these are stories that we're going to talk about and stories that will continue on for next week and the week after and the months after. It seems like we are never going to get done talking about the Flint water crisis. And now we've got criminal charges against the head of the Department of Health and Human Services. John, you were up in Flint, and Bill Schuette, the attorney general, laid out the case against the director of a state department. And it seems to me like these are going to be kind of difficult charges from based on what we've picked up since these charges were announced.
You have to prove a couple of things. You have to prove that they acted in a way that other public servants wouldn't have acted, given the same set of circumstances. You have to sort of connect their actions or lack of actions directly to the death of an 85-year-old gentleman who had other health issues. There's a lot there that has to get done in terms of proving these charges in a court beyond a reasonable doubt than I think we probably got a glimpse of on Wednesday, because obviously the prosecution, the charges, they're going to make the best case, they're going to put forward the best case, the strongest case. But we're a long way away from seeing these things resolved.
And Jacob, you were able to talk to some law professors who kind of concurred that this was going to be a very difficult case to make. What was their perception, and what was your takeaway after listening to them?
Yeah, I mean, they laid out a couple of the thresholds that John mentioned in terms of proving the recklessness action you take, and kind of what it means to prove the threshold for when there's a lack of action, and connecting that to someone's death. And both of the law professors I talked to really started off the conversation by pointing out that this is a homicide charge, that Bill Schuette is essentially accusing Nick Lyon of committing a homicide. And so it's going to be interesting to see how Bill Schuette and his team can make the case that this he is, in a way, responsible for this man's death.
I don't see Nick Lyon pleading or trying to cut a deal of any sort. Do you guys? I mean, if you've got the full faith of the governor to keep you on board as the Health and Human Services Director, why would you bother to even plea? It seems like you go ahead and just take this.
Well, you have to remember, too, I mean, the state's going to pay for his defense. So he's less likely to plea given that fact than whether he had to pay for his own defense, because obviously a defense in this kind of situation, the cost can mount very rapidly. So I don't see why he would, quote-unquote, take a plea. Even talking about him taking a plea sort of suggests there's something else there that,
well, right, and that's
that he has to give up, and I'm not sure that there is.
Well, and that's kind of what I was getting at here, Simon, is that if you plea, then you're pretty much saying that you're guilty of something, and I think the administration wants to make it very clear, we don't think we're responsible for anything.
Yeah, and that's where I think the perhaps the political rewards that Bill Schuette could reap from this sort of run out. The fact that Governor Snyder has come up and said that he has full faith in Director Lyon, and also the fact that the legislator has kind of said, we're going to sit this one out, we're not going to take a particular stance on this issue, it kind of leaves Bill Schuette in a position where he really has to deliver and has to show that these people are guilty. Otherwise, you know, this might have been $4 million that was just a waste of time.
$4 million being the cost, the running tab right now of his criminal investigation.
Yes, but of course, the fact that the November 2018 election may well, you know, happen and pass before there is any resolution in these cases might render the whole thing irrelevant.
Because we don't know who the next attorney general will be and if that person would be even interested in keeping these charges going. Other news happening in the Capitol, part-time legislature. It now appears, Jacob, that the Bureau of Elections doesn't have a problem with the ballot language that the Brian Kelly petition folks have submitted to them. But that doesn't mean everybody's okay. Patrick Anderson from the Anderson Economic Group has now come out with a letter that says there are a couple of sections of the Constitution that would be altered in case this made the ballot and this became added to the Constitution, one dealing with how the legislature could override a veto, and the other having to do with citizens' initiatives.
What Patrick Anderson is saying is those things were not listed in the petition. One of the technical requirements that you need to clear this approval to form to kind of get the bureaus okay on that, just again, the technical aspect, just needs to list what is change in the Constitution? What is altered? And so I think that's what Patrick Anderson is drawing attention to. We're obviously off from the substance of the petition and kind of what, if those things are good or bad, but I think he's pointing out that those were not listed in the petition. They need to be listed because people need to know what they're signing for. So that's the issue at hand here.
John, I sniff a lawsuit coming.
Well, I think he's starting to lay the groundwork for a lot of legal arguments that you can make, that this is a permanent change to the balance of power that we have currently in terms of the legislature versus the executive versus the judiciary. Because, I mean, think about it. If this goes into effect, the legislature can only express and exert its own will 90 days consecutively. You understand? I mean, if there is an emergency, they can't decide to come back and try to do something unless the governor asks them to. So, I mean, it permanently changes the balance of power. I think these are the kind of arguments that you're going to slowly see form sort of a Gordian knot around the legs of this proposal, and I wouldn't be surprised in the end take it out.
What worth seeing here, too, is Patrick Anderson is known around the town for bringing in term limits, right? He's the term limits guy. If you were to hire somebody to come and try and knock down the part-time legislature, well, shoot, why not the champion of term limits?
Well, and he does make a good point, though. I mean, remember, he did the initiative to repeal, I believe it was the single business tax, and his argument is, had this been in place, that could not have gotten done. So, I mean, he's got an example of, hey, look, I couldn't have accomplished this given the format that Brian Kelly and Clean Michigan want to put in place.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, John. And I think that although the ballot language, you know, proposes an amendment to the Constitution itself, I don't know if the role of government could essentially trip it up, or rather the changes in the power of the branches could. But I think that you speak to kind of the two sides of the dialogue that we're getting here with this part-time legislature initiative. On one side, the proponents of it believe that this is a referendum about the role of government. But whereas people who are, you know, maybe less keen on the idea of a part-time legislature, maybe even opposed to it, want to cast this as an issue that is about the role of the legislature relative to the other branches of government. And they are going to, I think it's going to be a struggle to convince the electorate to look at this as a larger picture rather than just the role of government generally.
Oh, I don't think it'll be the electorate that will make that decision based on, you know, that argument. I think it's going to be the courts that are going to say, because of all these other considerations, this was not crafted in a way that details and entails it as required by law.
And let's be honest, that's their best. Folks who are opposed to this, their best chance of defeating this is before it gets to the ballot, John.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be the courts that take it out of consideration, not people. If it gets on the ballot, I think it'll pass.
Yeah, I think it'll probably pass as well, probably pass fairly overwhelmingly. All right, well, we've got a couple other issues that we want to talk about. Let's move on to the interview and speak with Elmer Serrano. Joining us now on the podcast, Elmer Serrano with the Michigan Protection Advocacy Service. Thanks for joining us here at MERS World Headquarters today, Elmer.
Thank you. It's good being here.
Well, the conversation in the budget continues to revolve around the Section 298 in the budget, and it's a section that I've become more familiar with. I didn't think I would have to, but this has to do with this idea of taking Medicaid recipients and putting their physical and mental health coverage all in one and doing some kind of integrated plan that is run through an insurance company, an HMO or what have you. This budget that the House and the Senate has agreed to has created pilot programs where there would be four areas of the state that would test out this theory, see if the insurance company can provide better service for a person's physical and mental well-being at a cheaper cost. And I wanted to get your impressions of what's wrong with the idea of just testing this out through pilots.
The services have been wrong since the 1970s, community mental health systems. Is to say, now we're going to demonstrate. If we want to really identify what people need, we ask them, what supports do you need? The state laws and the federal laws say that you have to provide person-centered planning. So you ask the individual what they need for supports to get through life. And it's not just you do it once and it's all set. People's lives change. They evolve. Family relationships. It's not just a one system will fix it. That's a magic pill. It's talking to people. It's really figuring it out. What I'm concerned with the insurance companies is the process, they pick the easy target. The CMA systems are not efficient. Government's not efficient by nature. Insurance is good. They provide quality, but only in the dollar. They can evaluate whether or not they're getting the money to service appropriate, but it doesn't identify, is that what the person needs? And how do you respond to their change?
And you're concerned then that the insurance company then won't be as focused on individuals on a case-by-case basis, but instead try to institute some kind of cookie-cutter approach that will leave patients, in some cases, high and dry.
Oh, absolutely. Their action that we can provide this. Show us. How can you do that? Can you figure out how you can move money more efficiently? If you look right now, the CMH system, money comes to them from the state. It goes through the PIHPs. It goes through a number of different systems to provide the money for the services. But by the time that dollar gets down to service the individual, it's penny on the dollars. How can we run that more effectively? Insurance companies can say, oh yeah, we'll save you money. For what? What are you going to provide? How responsive are you going to be? Are you going to meet the needs of families, both mentally ill and people with developmental disabilities? How do you do that? We have experience. I had people say, oh, we'll take care of you. Really? What are you going to provide? No reaction. Oh, we'll take care. Thank you. That's not what I need.
You're not completely assured, I can tell. The Lieutenant Governor recently had a task force in which he invited all the stakeholders together, including the insurance company. At the very end, there was some recommendations, and none of them included a pilot program.
Funny.
So what's your impressions now? So now the legislature wants to do some pilot programs, even though the Lieutenant Governor did this task force and that was not among the recommendations.
Yeah, it was very valuable discussions from all the providers, the insurance companies, the providers, the advocates, people with disabilities. And we really spent 18 months in doing this stuff. At the end, it says, oh yeah, we're not going to do that. We're not going to accept any of the recommendations, we're going to run these models now. There was some value to that process. Nobody has all the answers. It's not just a money issue. I'm afraid of private for-profit corporations that will provide good image, and as long as they can turn a profit, they'll be around. People's needs are expensive. They can't provide it. They'll walk.
Are you concerned that the wheels are greased? If we have this kind of a pilot program, that the results will come back from somebody that says this was a fantastic experiment and this is something that should be expanded statewide, and then we'll get down this road and we'll just end up being a disaster?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Yeah. Because there's independent folks who are supposed to be doing the evaluation, right? We're supposed to have academia do the evaluations on the pilot and give their honest assessment as to what's happening. It's supposed to be a safeguard.
I'm afraid as a private company that can no longer turn a profit, it's harder than they thought, and they walk away. What's left for families? And I've talked to families that, my God, they're afraid for the kids or their family members. They're saying, what's going to happen, this service? They're not perfect now, but at least I know what it is. Give me better. Cheaper could be fine, but let me tell you what we need.
And what do you think could be done to better improve the service that folks are receiving in Medicaid for their
behavioral
health?
Say, if I was the governor, I would say, go back to committee. This legislation is not ready yet. It needs people to talk with each other, not to yell at each other, not take positions, but to say, how do we really guarantee that people with disabilities in the state are really the primary concern here? It's not all these fancy statistics. It's going to give me what people need.
The governor is going to presumably get some compromise language. He had some buy-in to what the legislature did. What do you know, if anything, about what the governor has asked for to be put into this?
It's confusing. What are they asking for? What do you want to demonstrate? How do you measure this? I think the committee work has yet to continue because they have to listen. Like last year, the advocate organizations and the people with disabilities said, don't give me this stuff. Tell me what you're talking about. I'll tell you what I need. We have to go back to figure out how are we going to make that work. We're an organization that represents the rights of people with disabilities. We don't have memberships. We don't have any obligation except for the individual with disabilities, them and their families. That's what we're here for. It's got to change. It's got to change. I just think now's the time to say, you know, let's take a breath. Let's go back and figure out how we're going to make this happen so it's a best quality service. Insurance may be a part of it. They may not. CMH may be the current structure. I think it's overstructured. I think there are too many CMHs. To go with one PHP might be a damn good idea. How do we give that responsibility in one entity so that we uniformity not throughout the state? And I don't mean that we have to protect everybody's in every area gets XYZ service. We have to say that we have to know through the state your quality is measured by whether or not the system is responsive. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, it's the process that's evaluated, not the outcome.
Last question I had for you, Elmer. When we asked the Lieutenant Governor about what he thought of this new provision in the budget, he seemed open to the pilot projects. Is that concerning in any way?
Well, his committee that got together over the last 18 months, he has the right, the willing heart to really look at what are the ways we can make this better. I think we have to be careful. Everybody has their dog in the fight here. I want people to say, look, we have these conflicts, whatever, so what? Let's talk about, without labels, let's talk about how do we really move it forward. The Lieutenant Governor, I think, has the right idea. When he pulled the committee together, we came up with good recommendations. Some areas we realized we don't know how to do this yet, but a willingness. And then it just goes the legislative process and think, where the hell to go? So it's been frustrating.
I'm sure. All right, Elmer Serrano with the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service. Thanks for joining us on the podcast
this
week.
Thanks.
All right, we're going to move on to the next portion of the podcast. We're going to speak with Representative Tom.
Joining us on the other end of the line is Representative Tom Albert. He's the representative from the 86th District, which is Kent County, parts of Ionia County. And more importantly, he has been the face on the House side for the changes on the teacher retirement options. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, Representative.
Thank you, Kyle. Glad to be here.
Well, give our listeners a little background on your interest in this subject and why this was something you were willing to tackle.
I started working for the State Pension Fund after I graduated at Michigan State. So I worked there for about 3 years, and I worked as an investor in different private investments. So I started in real estate and infrastructure, and then I moved over to different real assets and absolute return assets. So I have a pretty good understanding how pensions work from the inside. So then when I came to Lansing, I just started looking at the pension from the outside and how it works. You know, when I worked at the pension fund, our entire goal was 100% focused on getting an 8% return. So we didn't really look at, you know, how the contribution side of what goes into it. So when I came to Lansing, I was able to look at it from a more holistic standpoint. And I guess when I started to look at it, I saw some things I thought were a little troubling.
Well, let's talk about the investment and the return and so forth, because that's been some of the focus. 8% return has been the goal. Why has that been a challenge to achieve? Is it just because you can't estimate what the stock market's going to do, or are there internal problems?
No, it's not internal problems. It's more of a macro problem. I mean, if you looked at what asset allocation it took to get an 8% return 20 years ago, you could have largely got 8% through stocks and bonds. But, you know, 20 years later, we've had ultra-low interest rate policy from the Fed for going on 8 years now, and we just generally look from a global standpoint to be in a slower growth phase. It's just been unrealistic over the last, we'll say, 10 years to think that you could get an 8% return using the asset allocation from 20 years ago. So what they've had to do is layer on risk using different private investments. So that'd be private equity, hedge funds, different real assets. And the thing about those are they have a higher expected return, but they also have more volatility, so it adds risk to the portfolio as a whole.
So as part of this package, the risk or the rate of return that's expected on this new pension plan that is being crafted as part of this package is a 6% return on investment. And some of the critics from the education community have said, well, why don't you just take the current pension plan and just make that a 6% rate of return and we should be all set. We don't have to make any kind of reforms. What's wrong with that idea?
If I had my choice and we could lower all pension plans to 6%, I would be supportive of it. The thing is, and this is why I think public pensions have a lot of problems nationally, is that would cost hundreds of millions of dollars annually, and there's just not any room for it in the budget.
So explain how you came to this current package that ended up passing the House and passing the Senate, albeit a different but very identical bill.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the largest change from the bill I dropped to what we vote on the House is the creation of the new hybrid plan. So that would have, as you said, a lower assumed rate of return of 6%. It also has a 50-50 cost share between the employer and the employee. And then there's also the trigger, which if the funded ratio were to fall below 85% over 2 years, then that would trigger the plan to close. It's worth noting that funded ratio is based on an actuarial value of the fund, which is a five-year average. So it's a pretty large threshold to break that 85%. I think that would take a pretty sustained, almost economic depression to get to that phase. I think it's unlikely that trigger would get pulled, but. You know, basically, how did we get to that point? You know, it's just that's the way government works when you make laws. It was, you know, the administration, the Senate and the House getting together and crafting something that we could all support.
I was hosting a radio show this morning, had Doug Pratt from the MEA on. He had a couple criticisms that I'd like you to address. One of them was the speed with which this particular bill moved through the House. There was a substitute that folks got to see on Tuesday. Passed both chambers on Thursday. What's been your reaction to the argument that this thing has been jammed through the legislative process?
I think it's comical. It has been so public, and everybody knows that we've been working on MMSRs. Everybody knew that I was the point person in the House. There was, I think MERS even had a headline on it. Albert was the taking point on MMSRs or something like that. You know, and then when we had the committee meeting, the Democrats said that they only had 2 hours to draft a substitute. I think we were all elected on the same day, if I'm not mistaken, all sworn in on the same day. They could have been working on their plan that whole time, and they could have came and talked to me, but nobody did.
Okay. And then the other argument that they came up with is that there was a provision in here that said that that school employees, that current school employees, would no longer be able to buy service time except unless you were in the military. And that was something that they've enjoyed before for teachers who, let's say, have ill parents. They need to take a year or two off, or young children that being able to buy time would allow them to keep pace on their retirement schedule. What was the point of putting that provision in the bill?
Those service credits are damaging to the fund. I mean, pension plans are based on assumptions, and some of those assumptions are how many years you're going to work, what age you're going to be when you retire, what your wages are going to be when you retire, and when you allow people to purchase service credits, it throws off the whole model. People retire earlier than what they planned. They didn't put enough money in to pay for their accrued benefit, and what that does is it leaves an unfunded liability. they were harmful to the fund as a whole and to the health of the fund, which ultimately puts the Michigan taxpayer at risk. So they weren't very healthy to the fund, so that's why they need to be shut down.
And then the last question I had for you, clearly this isn't, as you mentioned, this isn't what you had originally put on the table, but just give me your impression on how the legislative process worked in that case. As with many pieces of legislation, you don't get everything that you want, but you did get something. How satisfied are you with that?
I'm happy with it. I think it's a really good piece of legislation. I think that we give teachers a better option now. The new defined contribution plan, I think, is very competitive. You know, one thing I was proud to get in there was the annuity option. So that way, if you want a guaranteed retirement income, you can still get it through the defined contribution plan. I was also glad to get in there the basically, I guess you'd call it the cost savings provision. So what that means is, in the future going forward, we wouldn't be able to lower our normal cost contribution or our debt payment. It sounds silly to say this, but the current practice is, if say you had some positive investment returns for the last 5 years, you could actually lower your annual contribution, which is just silly because an average has highs and lows. So when you have some positive years, you lower what your payment is. You're not planning to have an average. So I was glad to have that cost savings provision in there because it makes it a lot safer.
You know, I had just thought about this, but we had talked about the service credits, and one of the arguments during this whole conversation was that this wasn't going to impact current teachers. Could it be argued that this is going back and actually is impacting current teachers?
It doesn't impact their benefit. No. I mean, if you work 30 years, you still get the benefit that you were promised.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Representative Tom Albert from the 86th District. Appreciate you being on the MERS podcast today.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Representative Albert and Elmer Serrano for coming into MERS World Headquarters, which does have the comfiest chair in all of the Capitol. Jacob is going to move his computer and desk up here into John's office just so he can rock in the black comfy chair, I think.
I was just enjoying this new podcast recording area in John's office. This chair is very comfortable.
You know, he used to have a chair like that in his office downstairs, which was where the only TV was. But then we moved the chair out of the office. See, this is some MERS history.
Was a comfy chair by a TV affecting work productivity?
Well, only during the Final Four and the baseball practice or the baseball playoffs.
Well,
I think
I don't know the availability of seating affects the viewing of that at all.
That's
in this office.
We have a TV in the press room now, so that I don't lose. So that during the March Madness, I don't lose my office for 4 days in a row.
That is very true. Or during baseball playoff time too, especially if the Giants are in the playoffs, which I don't think we have to worry about this year, or the Tigers for that matter. I don't think. And in other news, Simon went to Cincinnati and did not get Skyline Chili, which I'm very disappointed about, Simon.
Sorry, Kyle, I only had one night, and there's so much city to explore. I was surprised.
Well, you should have brought some Skyline back for everybody.
And I got to ask, Simon, how was it to drive the daddy wagon?
Oh, man, it was great. Smooth ride, leather interior, all the features. It's got two sunroofs.
We're referring to Kyle's plush ride, which he has dubbed the daddy wagon.
It is the daddy wagon. It is, but you know what? Only one of those sunroofs go all the way back, because you can't have one in the back, or else the kids will pop out.
Yeah, out of the window.
Or better yet, them throwing their toys out of the roof.
We could have either or, and we don't want either of them. Special thanks to our sponsor, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all of our podcasts. Till next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.